You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On Sunday, a North Carolina man was charged with assault with a deadly weapon after he entered a pizzeria in Washington, D.C., pointed a gun at an employee, and then fired shots inside the building. The man claimed to have been investigating a conspiracy that ties the pizzeria with a satanic cult, child abuse, and Hillary Clinton. It's the latest example of the power of fake news, which has surged during this election season. To try to understand this new epidemic, the people behind it, the people who share it, and why it goes viral, we are joined now by Terrence McCoy, social issues reporter for The Washington Post, and Shira Frenkel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Shira, can you explain the conspiracy theory involving the pizzeria? It seems so far-fetched. It's hard to believe that anybody would take it seriously.
It does. And to be honest, I don't know if really getting into the detail of it is going to serve readers, other than to say it is one of many, many theories out there involving the Clintons, involving members of the Democratic Party, which are created to sort of paint them in as bad a life as bad a light as possible. This one involved child sex escorts and other sort of lurid happenings at this particular pizza parlor. And I think it's interesting, this particular one, because it shows that nothing is so far-fetched that people are not willing to believe it when they see it online.
And one prominent person who's been spreading this rumor is the son of Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Hasn't he been part of the Trump transition team?
He hasn't, and he has actually, you know, come out and tweeted, and even now in the wake of that attack, we haven't seen any kind of retraction from him. He's not the only member as well of Trump's team or people around him who have been tweeting fake news both during the campaign and afterwards.
One prominent company that's behind a lot of fake news online is Disinformedia, started by Justin Kohler. What's the goal of a company like that one?
Well, I think that there's a number of companies, and fake news has kind of become the very general term that we use to describe it all. What they are is just misleading or sometimes outright false news articles. And some are created by people here in the United States because they can turn a profit. Someone clicks on the article, someone shares the article, and they make money from advertisements. Quite a few of these other sites are run by teenagers in Macedonia and other parts of Europe because, again, they've seen this as a way to make money. And then, of course, there's the third category that people have worried about, and that's articles that are purposefully planted by other countries trying to sort of spur disinformation campaigns in the United States. And all of these combined have sort of created a climate where there's a lot of news items online or things purporting to be news items, which are meant to sort of mislead you or just kind of paint a worldview in which everything is a conspiracy.
I would say what we're seeing right now is very different than what we've seen in the past, and the fact that there's always been lots of misinformation that has bled into the American mainstream. But what we've seen now is almost the weaponization of misinformation as well as the monetization of misinformation. You look at a number of these websites, they have found a way to be able to exploit people's fears and biases and suspicions in order to turn a profit. And this is something that's new. There's always been misinformation in American culture. Back in 1938, Orson Welles, there was the War of Worlds that was said on radio, and hundreds and thousands of Americans phoned into local police stations to say they were worried about the Martians invading. I mean, this is something that's been going on for a long period of time where people are worried and they can be suspicious of things. But what's different now is the fact that people are turning big bucks off of this. They're making a lot of money off of people's suspicions.
In the case of Justin Kohler, he claims that he started his Disinformedia company as an attempt to discredit the so-called alt-right. It's obvious that his plan has backfired.
But News of the World also made money. I mean, these places, these tabloids have always made money. I think now the difference is that any Joe Schmo sitting in the back of his, you know, apartment can do this. You don't need a major newspaper. You don't need to print anything. You literally need nothing but the couple dollars it might take to sort of start a new site. So anyone can do this. Anyone in the world can do it. It makes them quite a bit of money. And there's no address to go to. There's no door to knock on to say, hey, stop this. Please, you know, discontinue what you've been doing. As opposed to the past, we sort of gatekeepers of the media that you could go and address.
Wasn't the Internet structured to be democratic, although no one seemed to have imagined that would encourage the dissemination of fake news?
And that's what's interesting about this is the fact that misinformation in a number of key categories has advantages over information and fact. misinformation can be molded to fit somebody's worldview or their personal biases. And when that happens, they're more likely to share it on their Facebook page, they're more likely to share it on their Twitter feed, and that can create these echo chambers where people are more or less just preaching to others, like-minded individuals. And it creates a self-reinforcing loop where one false or misleading story can ultimately become huge in this community because it fits all these people's personal beliefs. And fact and actual information all of a sudden becomes very weakened in that sort of environment because it doesn't fit those people's beliefs, so they're not going to share it. They're not going to put it out to their friends because they don't want to believe it. So in these situations, misinformation can become even more powerful than information can become.
And then when they distrust fact-checkers, if the New York Times or the Washington Post says that this is not true, that's just part of the conspiracy.
That's right, and that's one of the most dangerous things we're seeing right now is the fact that the New York Times did a big story on what we were talking about a moment ago with Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria in Washington, D.C., pretty much saying, you know, debunking this entire ludicrous conspiracy theory. But that actually reinforced it in a number of people's eyes because they perceive the New York Times to be a part of this liberal media establishment, and anything that they're writing is part of this lie. I actually experienced this myself when I did a story on a couple of guys who are writing a lot of misleading and misinformed articles out of a Long Beach apartment. After I wrote this article, these writers kind of used it as a way to say, look, the Washington Post lies. This is part of the fake news. They're part of the fake news more than we are, and it becomes a sort of back and forth where the people who are writing the fake news are accusing the mainstream media of doing fake news.
Sherry, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to add for a moment about how sort of the internet makes this all possible. Out here in San Francisco, that's the main thing that people are focusing on. We're talking about people whose entire lives are invested in the creation of the internet. And looking at all this, they're sort of asking themselves what happens next. I mean, they call this the sort of Wild West days of the internet, where we're really just beginning to understand the capacity of what's possible. And on the one hand, people see the damage of fake news, especially major companies like Facebook and Twitter and Google, who are trying to figure out what to do next. On the other hand, the very principles that their companies are founded on is that sort of everything is shareable and everything should be shareable. We should all be living our lives online and sharing information with people who we care about. So I think it's interesting to see these companies at sort of a real crossroads of their founding principles and sort of what to do next.
I'm speaking with Shira Frenkel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News, and Terrence McCoy, the social issues reporter for The Washington Post. And Terrence, you mentioned that you went to meet these guys who in Long Beach who created a website called Liberty Writers News.
That's right. They created this website back in, I think it was June of this year, and they are more or less a case study in how quickly a group or a Facebook page or a website can tap into a surging ideology and use that to, or more or less just ride it into internet notoriety or to the fact that these men who are both 26 years old, they started this Facebook page and they started this website 6 months ago, and in that amount of time they have nearly 1 million followers now on Facebook. This is a massive audience. And the way that they've been able to do that is a really clear case study of how a number of websites do it. It's more or less just kind of cultivating and inflaming a lot of people's biases and prejudices to the point where you can create a massive audience by every day kind of stoking or feeding those readers what they want. They're very clear about the fact that, say, we are part of the echo chamber, and our whole job is more or less just confirmation bias. There's a bias, and we're out there to confirm it. And the most important thing is to give readers what they want. And what readers wanted to read was that Hillary Clinton was going to jail, that Donald Trump was this avenging hero who was going to save America from villainous global financiers. This is what their audience wanted to read, and they had no problem giving that to them under the idea that this is just how capitalism works in America. You know, this is the way to make a buck, and we're going to make a buck doing it.
But don't these two gentlemen, Paris Wade and Ben Goldman, say that they're politically liberal? Is this just a very cynical way to make a buck? And how are they making a buck?
Both both of them have voted for Barack Obama in 2008 as well as in 2012. They consider themselves more moderate. They've always been more culturally liberal. After 2012, when they both graduated college around that time, they went through a period of disillusionment where they became increasingly convinced that a lot of what Obama was saying about today's America was not true. So they do, to some extent, believe some of the things that they're writing. But also what they mostly believe is we want to be able to build an audience, and if we build an audience, we can make money off this. And the way that they make money off of this is by rapidly building this Facebook page, which will then channel readers into their website, in which they make lots of money off of these sort of splashy advertisements where you feel like when you go to their website, you're going to get a virus in your computer or something, like very graphic sort of advertisements.
And what kinds of companies advertise on these sites?
There's one company that they have two major advertisers, but just these sort of big internet advertisers. AdSense, I believe, is one of them that you buy through them, and they put advertisements on your website, and just that's how you turn a profit.
Well, Kellogg's just recently made a lot of people angry when it decided it wasn't going to put any ads on Breitbart. So there's often retribution if companies don't advertise in these places.
But there's also a back and forth where Kellogg, a lot of Breitbart readers say, we're not going to buy cornflakes anymore. But on the other hand, a lot of folks who support Kellogg's decision, they're going to go out and buy cornflakes. It's kind of what we're seeing right now is this politicization of just basic commercial objects that we hadn't seen before. New Balance shoes is now the shoe of many white supremacists. And so they're going to go out and buy it, but folks who don't agree with that ideology aren't going to buy it. And this is something that I think is very new in both American commerce and American politics.
Now, in their articles, Wade and Goldman frequently write about globalists. What do they mean by that?
A globalist is kind of this, in a lot of new right and alt-right and far-right fringe sort of bloggers and people who are tweeting, it's kind of a catch-all term for this sort of shadowy financial elite, folks who want to tear down all the borders and make everything sort of a borderless, free trade zone. And what the idea is that those sort of globalists are only in it for themselves, and they're not in it for the regular folks who are losing their jobs as a result of it. But they're doing it, and they're alleging that these so-called globalists are doing it in a massive collusive effort that spans from the United States across Europe through many, many countries, pretty much in cahoots with one another in order to disenfranchise many of the working class people.
Sounds like an update of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yeah, or the Illuminati, you're right. Yeah.
And they say that they've been using the headline, "The media doesn't want you to see." They've used it 1,000 times, beyond the fact that that's grammatically incorrect. That does make a point to the kinds of people who read their articles. Did they play a role in the Pizzagate conspiracy?
No, that's interesting. I actually did a search for that yesterday to see if they had, but they had not, from what I could tell. But when I was out there with them, the Pizzagate conspiracy was at first just starting. I was with them from November 8th, the night of the election, for a couple days afterward. And the Pizzagate conspiracy theory really started going at the end of October. And but this was something that they definitely had on their radar, that they were asking me about it even. They're like, have you heard of this place called Comet? And I was like, you know, it's a pizzeria. But apparently what they were seeing in a lot of their circles of people sharing the different stories was that, you know, this was what they were alleging it to be. So they didn't play a role in it, but they definitely had their finger on the pulse of a lot of these sort of conspiracy theories that are percolating.
An interesting part of that conspiracy was that much of this activity was taking place in the basement, and it turns out the pizzeria doesn't have a basement. But, you know, let's not confuse ourselves with facts. My guests are Terrence McCoy, social issues reporter for The Washington Post, Shira Frenkel, a cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. We will continue our conversation after this. We're talking about fake news with Terrence McCoy, social issues reporter for The Washington Post, and Shira Frenkel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed. Shira, what's Facebook's official position on fake news?
Well, we've seen their position shift. Right after the election, Mark Zuckerberg gave an open sort of policy speech in which he said that it was a crazy idea that Facebook and the fake news published on Facebook had affected these elections. And I think in the wake of that, he saw sort of such a severe backlash that the company has now taken a much more nuanced stance. And we've seen them, along with Twitter and Google and other companies, sort of come together and potentially say, we're going to try and work on this and come up with a policy and come up with a strategy. And Facebook has been beta testing a number of different sort of solutions. One includes having readers flag fake news or misleading news as they see it on their Facebook feeds. But I think they're struggling because they don't want to be the arbitrators of news. I think they understand that if Facebook starts deciding what's news and what's not news, it opens them up for a host of problems. On the other hand, they've let this go on for so long, and such a great number of fake news sites are now proliferating on their platform that they know they have to do something. So I think we're going to see in the next couple months a number of things being tested across the platform to try and stop fake news sites from continuing there.
Academics and Facebook employees have said that Facebook's algorithm is designed in a way that perpetuates fake news stories.
Facebook's algorithm is designed in a way that it perpetuates whatever echo chamber you're in. So it looks at what you click on, it looks at what you like, your friends sharing, and then it keeps giving you that. And so whatever your worldview is, whether it's that, you know, Trump should be the president or that Clinton should have won, it's going to encourage that. And I think, unfortunately, we live in a world where the most salacious sort of news, the most salaciously written articles, are the ones that make it to the top of our news feed. It's the ones we click on or potentially like or share. And so Facebook keeps giving those to us. And, yeah, it's a question of whether they tweak their algorithms. But, I mean, what can they do if that's what people want to share? If people want to share sort of the most gruesome thing they've seen that day.
It could lead to me not being able to share my opinions about somebody, a coworker, for example. They're afraid of censorship, I imagine. But doesn't the company now have an unofficial task force dedicated to stopping fake news?
Right. So that's something I wrote about in the week following the election, essentially following Zuckerberg's comment that it was crazy. I think that really ignited a group of Facebook employees to try and tackle it themselves. And they sort of went rogue. They started meeting secretly within the company and tried to come up with a method internally to solve this problem. Facebook then, a week later, announced that it also had an official group within the company that was working on it. So they're now trying to be seen publicly as really doing something to address this. But even within the company, the people I'm continuing to speak with say, is this too little, too late? Where were we months ago when all of this was feeding into the sort of crazy news cycle around these elections?
But didn't the Facebook employees prefer to speak to you anonymously? Are they meeting in secret?
They're meeting in secret, and to this day they've only spoken anonymously because they have to sign. I mean, Facebook has non-disclosure agreements upon non-disclosure agreements. And so all of them were sort of breaking those agreements with the company in order to speak to me and were fearful of not just losing their jobs but no longer being able to work within the tech industry if they did speak with their legal names.
Is this issue connected to Facebook's previous controversy when the website Gizmodo reported that Facebook employees were pushing liberal-leaning stories on the trending topics page?
I don't think it is. And in fact, quite a few of the Facebook employees I spoke to weren't doing this from a political mindset. They weren't doing it because Trump won or they wanted Hillary to win. And quite a few of them actually talked about what a massive problem this is outside of the United States. And that's something I've been writing about quite a bit recently. I traveled to Myanmar, where fake news is encouraging vicious attacks against Muslims living in Myanmar by Buddhist monks who run articles saying that, you know, that hordes of Muslims are killing Buddhists in Thailand and other such things and ignite these kind of mobs to go attack Muslims living in Myanmar. So this is a problem here in the United States, where we already have outlets like NPR and the New York Times that have been operating for years and that people trust and depend on. But what happens in the rest of the world when there isn't that kind of steady media climate, when they don't have reliable news sources and the only thing they're seeing is fake news articles online? And so these Facebook employees were saying, we're looking at the rest of the world now. We're looking at where Facebook is trying to expand globally and saying we've got to get this under control before those countries sort of ignite civil wars on the basis of things that are published on our platforms.
Would stopping anonymity help?
I mean, Facebook already has a sort of a real name policy where people are meant to be using their real name. Of course, that's very, very difficult to enforce across the company. And I don't know that anonymity would necessarily help, because a lot of people are quite sort of proud about the things they post online, and whether those articles are fake or misleading or whatnot, they're happy to be at the helm of anything that sort of gets popular support and gets shared widely.
Terrence, did Wade and Goldman tell you that they, in some cases, their articles outperform real news articles online?
Yeah, I would say a perfect sort of encapsulation of that is a number of months ago, Hillary Clinton gave a speech about the alt-right, and they put the video up on her Facebook page, or they put it up on her YouTube, and then there was sort of a countervailing narrative about what that speech was, and that was put out by this man who runs Danger or Play, and his video far outperformed what his video, pretty much poking fun of and insulting what she was saying, far outperformed what she had put out there. There is this right now, we're seeing that, and they would talk about this, Liberty Writers News, they would say, you know, our impact on social media was such, and it was greater than a lot of legacy news organizations.
And hasn't Facebook banned or blocked some of their articles?
What happens is Facebook has a number of algorithms, and what they suspect, I mean, Facebook isn't very open about how these algorithms sometimes work, but what they suspect is that if a article starts trending in a very large fashion from an unverified source, a source that doesn't have one of those blue check marks, Facebook might automatically assume that this is spam or something to that effect, and they will temporarily ban that. And this is something that does temper to some degree some of these alt-right or fringe sort of outlets, these underground outlets are writing, but it doesn't catch all of them, and that's only for something that's going exceptionally viral. For a number of other articles, it kind of flies underneath that, and those can simmer for a long period of time. And what we see is that those articles, when they're written in such a way, when they target emotions, because a lot of these articles just target emotions, they don't target people's sort of sentience or what they are thinking. It's all about the emotive core, and when you target someone's emotive core, they just reshare it without even thinking themselves. It just kind of goes from one person to the next, and that is really what we see become almost like a digital wildfire. It flames, and then it goes everywhere. Before you know it, it's just kind of suffocating an entire echo chamber.
And where do they get the ideas for their articles? Are they picking up other people's ideas, or are they just making them up? How much is inspired by people like Alex Jones?
A lot of it is. I mean, it's not just the writers I wrote about. It's a number of, I mean, a lot of the writers that Cher was talking about in Macedonia. What it is the fact that to a certain degree, there is no bound to what people will believe. I mean, people were believing that this pizzeria was running a international syndicate, a crime syndicate from their basement that doesn't even exist. I mean, that shows how far people will believe things. But at the same time, there needs to be, it's almost like these sort of gumshoe activities where they're trying to connect the dots together to some extent, and almost like bits and pieces where there's one shred of what they claim to be evidence that they'll then say represents a much broader something out there. The Podesta emails were just an incredible well of material for all of these conspiracy theorists, because they could just read into any of these emails whatever they believed, and they could just say that this email meant this or that, or this or that, and it just spawned just innumerable number of conspiracy theories. The WikiLeaks drops spawned innumerable conspiracy theories, because people could just take these emails and put them completely out of context and say this is representative of something much bigger, much more sinister, and then they write an article about it, and then it'll just go everywhere. And this is really what we've seen in the last number of months.
My guests are Terrence McCoy, socials issues reporter for The Washington Post, and Shira Frankel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. We're talking about fake news. And Shira, you wanted to add something.
I did. I just wanted to say one of the really interesting things to come out of the WikiLeaks email drop was how that sort of reinforced people's views. The fact that they could go to WikiLeaks themselves and see the original emails seemed to really sort of give backing to a lot of these conspiracy theories. And I think it's one of the sort of side effects of WikiLeaks and the WikiLeaks effect that we haven't really even begun to understand.
But then we have these other kinds of wild stories that many people believe, like the one that Barack Obama is gay, Michelle is a transsexual, and their children were abducted, similar to the pizzeria story. Some of them are so outrageous, it's hard to believe anyone would believe them. Is it just a matter of wanting to believe the worst about the people you don't respect?
Yeah, I mean, I think the people who believe those articles are already so far down the rabbit hole that they'll really believe anything they see that reinforces their worldview that Obama and that Michelle are sort of these, you know, the worst of the worst, that they've misled everyone and made their way to the White House, that Obama was a Manchurian candidate. I mean, they're really willing to believe anything about the Obamas. I do think that the vast majority of people will kind of look at those articles and not necessarily share them or believe them. They're a lot more likely to believe the things that link back to WikiLeaks, that have an email and, as Sharon said, taken out of context and you know, clipped to sort of reinforce what they want reinforced. But they're more likely to believe that than I think the really sort of crazy out there pizza parlor and you know, fake marriage rumors.
You mentioned Myanmar. Fake news has also become an international problem. What's the German government doing about fighting fake news on Facebook? Or haven't they threatened to take legal action?
Yes, they have. I mean, we've seen the EU and specifically Germany sort of be at the forefront of all this. They're taking it the most seriously, and they've posed the most sort of serious challenge to Facebook, saying that if Facebook doesn't do something to hasten its response time to removing fake news, that they're going to start taking actions to levy penalties and fines against Facebook. And it's the only government that's sort of forced a response out of Facebook, and Facebook has met repeatedly with them and said that they will do better and that they are working on the issue.
But that's because Germany has laws against hate speech, and there's been a lot of hate speech on Facebook.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is that all of this is interesting because all of this stems from Germany's hate speech laws. And the items that they've been the most upset about are those that was one that was, for instance, mapping Jews and Jewish-owned businesses across Germany. And that was repeatedly requested to be taken down off Facebook. Facebook did not respond until finally sort of very high-level German officials intervened and forced them to. So it all stems from Germany's hate speech laws, but they see a broader issue here, and it's going to affect their upcoming national elections as well. They don't want to see fake news spread in Germany the way it did in the United States.
A listener wonders if we're normalizing fake news by calling it fake news. Should we be calling it propaganda?
I actually made that same point on Twitter this morning, as I sometimes worry about calling it fake news because it, to some degree, euphemizes what this is, and it can be significantly more dangerous than that. To some degree, if people are doing it with a concerted point to say, I'm going to write fake news or I'm going to put this falsehood out there in order to make money, I mean, this is really just lie mongering. This is a concerted campaign to inundate the populace with misinformation to make money. And to that extent, I mean,
some of it, but I mean, some of it, right? Some of it's propaganda, and others aren't. I mean, I think it's hard. It's very, very tricky. And of course, we want people to take it seriously. And I agree, like, fake news is not a perfect term. But I don't think all of it's propaganda. I think some of it is just teenagers in their basement trying to make money. And if it happens to work as propaganda in favor of one candidate or another, then that's just a side effect to them. So I'm not sure what the perfect term is, but I think we need to be careful about that.
But for most of us, the people who use Facebook as a news source, how can you tell whether a news story is real or fake? Aren't there websites that have very similar URLs to real news sites? There's one, abcnews.com.co, that's a fake news source.
That's right, and, and it's not just that. There's U.S. Politicus, and there's a number of different variations of spelling in order to be able to make these websites' URLs look more official and to some way that does hoodwink a lot of people where they say, well, I recognize that brand or it seems like an official source, so I'm going to click on it. I mean, it's to the same extent that a lot of scams have always worked. I mean, if you have the same sort of insignia, the same sort of similar-sounding name, people are more likely to believe it. But I think an important point here is the fact that a lot of the discussion that's going on surrounding fake news right now is really targeted at a lot of folks who believe this stuff on the right. It is not exclusive to folks who are believing this stuff on the right. There are a lot of folks on the far left who believe the same thing. This is just a situation where folks on either fringe are believing more and more of whatever they can. I mean, there's been a number of false stories that were spread about Donald Trump as well during the election. It's not just one or the other. It's just a whole you know, outgrowth of what we've seen with social media and misinformation.
Some tech experts. Go ahead, Cher.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, I think BuzzFeed actually analyzed the top left-wing and right-wing sites on Facebook and found that the top right-wing sites shared fake news. I hope I get these numbers right. It was something close to 32 or 33% of the time, and that the top left-wing sites shared it 21 or 22% of the time. So it's clearly an issue on both sides, but as you said, more on the right-wing than the left-wing.
Some tech experts suggest using a reverse image search to find out if a photo is legitimate. Can that work?
That's complicated for the average person to do. I mean, we do it when we're trying to check news stories, but I can't imagine the average American doing a reverse image search on everything that comes across their path. I mean, what I would encourage people to do is no matter where they see the news item, they can see it on the New York Times, Washington Post, or BuzzFeed, but check it for yourself. Google it. See if it makes sense. I mean, I think that sort of the flip side of all this is that you can Google anything, and you can sort of look around for yourself and decide whether or not you want to believe a news item, no matter where it's published. And hopefully that's something people start to do more of in the future.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. Shira Frenkel is a cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Terrence McCoy is social issues reporter for The Washington Post. We've been talking about, I'm going to say, so-called fake news, because now supposedly we're told to say so-called alt-right. There's an awful lot of so-calls out there.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.